I'm a primary care internist with a master's in public health and administration for University of Michigan. In a former life, I was a part-time 501c3 charitable HMO medical director for 10 years before I decided there was no good work to be done in the health insurance industry. Took a substantial salary cut to get away from it. I continue to teach internal medicine. I'm in charge of a 36-resident internal medicine program in Toledo at a large Catholic hospital that has been teaching either nurses or doctors since the 1850s. So we've got a good tradition there. What I want to talk about is what I've seen in my own community and decided to look a little further at across the country, which is this issue of merger mania, the consolidation of smaller healthcare providers into larger and larger organizations. Maybe I'll make some comments about the transition into more of a corporate rather than small business mindset and what that might mean to us as patients and providers of healthcare. And I've no financial interest other than I do have my salary paid for by a hospital, and I'm talking about the industry in general here if one considers that a conflict. So I'm going to start by talking about what I've seen in my own experience in Northwest Ohio. I came to Toledo, Ohio in 1972 to go to medical school. And in 1972, there were 8 independent hospitals with a wide variety of different affiliations and backgrounds. There was an osteopathic hospital. There were 2-3 Center City hospitals that were scattered around, 2 suburban hospitals, and 3 large teaching hospitals, including one that was affiliated with the university in town. And over the last 40 years, what's happened is gradually those hospitals have merged into functionally 2 systems. So we went from 8 independent hospitals to 2. You could say maybe 2.5. The medical school, because the 2 systems, one is a Catholic health system, the other is a non-Catholic healthcare system. The medical school, which has a very small hospital and has been has needed the other hospitals in town to do their teaching, have kind of been drawn into the sphere of the non-Catholic healthcare system, even though they don't have a strong teaching tradition, because they can do full-service obstetrics, and you can't be a medical school without an obstetrical department. So the issue of full-service obstetrics has pulled the medical school into their sphere, and subsequently the medical school is weakened very much by that politically within our community, by that necessity of being whipsawed at any time the other large and very wealthy, I might add, healthcare system decides to whip them around. They can, because no OB for the opportunities for their residents. You basically are shutting down the medical school. And even though that's an incredible community asset, both the university and its medical school in our town, just seems like, you know, that doesn't come into the thinking of some of the leaders of that other hospital system. Similarly, as this has happened, we've had independent physicians merge into 4 mega groups. When I first came to Toledo, it was all relatively small practices. The largest practice was a small group practice called Toledo Clinic, which had about 20 to 30 doctors at that time across multiple specialties. And outside of that, most doctors were in small private practices, small groups. But over the last 40 years, again, we've seen with this merger in the hospital systems and the ability of the hospital systems to put pressure on physicians, and with the insurance companies making contracts with the healthcare systems and then telling the doctors, if you don't have contracts with those same insurance companies, you're not going to be able to practice in our hospital, or putting pressure in that direction, we've gone into now basically 4 large groups, 3 of which are owned by the 2.5 hospital systems. So our Catholic system has 1 300-member medical group that's spread all over Northwest Ohio, a very similar, even slightly larger medical group spread over Southeast Michigan and Northwest Ohio for the not-for-profit large health system. And then lastly, the medical school faculty who have their own group, but again, are under the sway of the other hospital system. And then prior large, at one time, multi-specialty group has grown some, including incorporating physicians who don't want to ally themselves, become allied with either of the large healthcare systems. So this is kind of the last independent bastion, and yet it is probably about 100 people in that group, gone from maybe 30, 40 to 100 physicians, including some offices around town which are using common facilities. And the thing that really sparked off my thinking about this incredible merger in Northwest Ohio, of all the systems, eight independent hospitals, hundreds of independent practices, down into this boiled down 2.5 hospital systems, 4 mega groups, was an antitrust case that was brought as the last independent hospital was going to be absorbed by the not-for-profit healthcare system, the non-Catholic one. And the FTC stepped in and said, gee, you're really going to be too concentrated to market. Well, we were already too concentrated to market. I don't know why they got all excited about the last hospital being pulled into one of the two system spheres. But they brought an antitrust case and blocked the merger. And it became a big conversation point in Northwest Ohio about, oh, you know, suddenly people woke up and noticed this had happened in Northwest Ohio. But I think the more remarkable thing is it isn't just Northwest Ohio. This is happening all over the country. And certainly in my experience, having worked in a teaching hospital where the leadership was immediate and proximal to me, now the leadership is more than 100 miles, probably almost 200 miles away in Cincinnati, Ohio. And almost anything that we need to do has to walk through layer after layer of bureaucracy now, both for patient care issues sometimes and for educational issues within our institution. And the way that has slowed down the ability to do the things that need to be done in a nimble, changing educational or healthcare environment has been quite disturbing to me and some of my colleagues who work there. But these mergers have been in the business news, and I look back to kind of see what was going on, how did this kind of come to be. So I'm going to run through a few quotes here because I thought this was pretty remarkable. This goes back to around 2010. 4 years ago. The time has passed for hospitals to think that their future won't include alignment with other hospitals or physicians group, said Ellen Lutch-Bender, president of Boston-based healthcare consulting group Bender Strategies. No institution can secure its future by going alone.
Boom!
Right? I mean, and this is going to, I'll show you similar sorts of things here. Kansas City should see an uptick in hospital mergers, 2010 as well. Justice Department, Federal Trade Commission adjusted national standards regarding hospital market share concentration, and this thing called the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, reclassifies Kansas City as an unconcentrated market. So that's kind of like saying to a bee, here's a bowl of honey, right? Because the transaction specialists knew that this is an area of the country where they could once again kind of do their scary, you guys better get together or you will fail. And so no antitrust concerns in Kansas City. Well, let me tell you that exactly what happened soon after that is there were mergers in Kansas City. A couple other articles. I didn't take specific quotes from them, but this is from 2012 and 13. Affordable Care Act driving healthcare mergers. Healthcare costs overlooked factor in the New York Times, which is these mergers. So if you actually look, Healthcare Acquisition Report, again, another consulting agency. Many observers believe that the increased prevalence of consolidations experienced represents a material increase in transaction activity correlated in part to hospital preparation for reforms from the Affordable Care Act. Billions of dollars are spent annually on transactional costs, capital expenses related to hospital consolidations. Annual hospital transaction costs peaked at $10.3 billion in 2010. I can tell you there were even more transactions actually in 2013-14. They just didn't have the data yet. So we're spending tens of billions of dollars creating these new merged entities, which have moved further, you know, the community control further and further away to large corporate offices, which are often off, you know, in another city somewhere. Here's another kind of scary thing that the hospital executives would be reading from should be considering mergers and acquisitions, DHG Healthcare, another healthcare consultant, in the winter of 13. Organizations that provide healthcare in the United States, both hospitals, physicians, have experienced seismic shifts in the last 20 years. Well, no fooling. Most of it, again, driven by the marketeers. One of the more significant industry trends involves hospital consolidation to create larger hospital systems with broader service reach, economies of scale to combat growing strategic, economic, and regulatory pressures. So what are they talking about? That when you're bigger, you can't be cut out of managed care contracts. So their concentrated interests of the insurance industry are now being matched by concentrated interests in the hospital industry and among physicians as well. Hospital executives should be considering mergers. Again, nationally, not-for-profit hospitals represent 78% of the market since 2001, but during that time frame, for-profit hospitals have been involved in 67% of the merger transactions. So the other thing we can see is one of the things that's probably behind this, and maybe even behind some of the activities in the executive offices, is the opportunity to consolidate and grow and gain ever higher salaries for those that are involved in both the board of directors positions and in the hospital executive positions. And you can see in larger systems that the size of the executive salaries are directly proportionate to the size of the systems. More on mergers and acquisitions, this now up to 2014. The new mandate driving the next wave of hospital consolidation is sheer survival. Boo! This is the stuff the consultants are telling the hospital executives, right? Another scary thing, sheer survival. In the new economy, the case for hospital consolidation has shifted from the revenue side of equation to improved efficiency and reduction of expenses. As hospital consolidation continues, healthcare providers need to assess the pressures associated with remaining independent, whether a sale, merger, or other partnership, will better help deliver its patient care mission and remain successful. Again, it's like a stampede, this sort of drumbeat, all based on the healthcare consultants who actually are making tens of billions of dollars driving these mergers forward. Now, there are economic pressures as well because of the consolidation in the insurance systems as well. But one of the things that we know is that oligopolies do not compete, and that's basically what we're doing, is we're galloping toward oligopoly, even on the local basis. So what's the impact of this? Has somebody been looking at it? Well, Robert Wood Johnson took a look. 2 decades ago, there were on an average 4 rival health systems of roughly equal size in each metro area. By 2006, it was down to 3. In our community, it's down to 2 and maybe a half. More than 1,000 hospital system mergers have occurred since the mid-1990s, often involving dozens of hospitals. In 2002, doctors owned about 3 in 4 practices. By 2008, more than half were owned by hospitals. And I can tell you that's way above that in my community. And again, so this is 2008 data, and I showed you that the peak of mergers was 2010. So we still don't even know, and then this past year it kind of bounced back up again. So we don't even know how concentrated the physician stuff will become, because we don't have data yet on that. The share of metropolitan areas with highly concentrated hospital markets by the standards of the antitrust enforcers at the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission rose to 77% from 63% over the prior decade. So we've actually, therefore, got functionally concentrated markets in almost all of the urban areas of the U.S. at this point. And again, what we know is that oligopolies do not compete. We will find that what the impact is on our healthcare costs is going to be substantially in the upward direction. So expanded evidence on competition and quality shows that competition leads to higher quality when there are administered prices. That means in a public system where there's control over what can be demanded, that quality and cost seem to do better under those circumstances. This would be such as with Medicare and its administered prices. The evidence is less straightforward when prices are market determined, and I'll tell you that there's evidence probably to some extent to the opposite direction. A review of research on physician hospital consolidation does not suggest that such consolidation, absent true integration, will lead to cost reductions, clinical improvement, and may lead to enhanced market power for providers. So some people have actually done a little better research on this, which is that a guy named Daphne from Northwestern, who actually looked at what happened after competitors merged in a given market. And what he found was is that there was a one-time increase in price of about 40% in the area where the hospitals were serving, where a rival was merged. So these mergers are actually driving hospital prices up by as much as 40% in this gentleman's research. Similar sort of look at things. 2003, we estimated because of the hospital mergers, private insurance rolls, probably because of price increases, actually dropped 0.3 percentage points. So there was more uninsured when there were more mergers. This equaled approximately, their estimate, 695,000 lives, the vast majority of whom probably lost private insurance because of the hospital mergers. And again, he's looking in 2003, way before the peak of these mergers. So there's also a possibility that, that the mergers of these hospitals have been driving an increase in the number of uninsured. Our estimates imply that hospital mergers result in a cumulative consumer surplus loss. That is to say, we're getting gouged, to be quite economist talk here, but we're getting gouged by about $42 billion between 1990 and 2001. And again, this is all way before the peak of this. So that is estimated that of all that $42 billion that went away in terms of consumer reduced costs, the increased costs that was handed off to consumers, only a modest $95 million actually got transferred to providers. So in this merger, even though the providers were stampeded into these mergers thinking, oh, it'll help us financially, it'll stabilize us financially, we'll be bigger and stronger, only $95 million of the $42 billion that got squeezed out of the system went to the providers. The rest of it went to the transaction specialists, the people who are merging these systems. So you create the stampede. When they go over the cliff, you cut up the dead and eat them for steaks. I mean, that's kind of my view of what's going on here with the transaction specialists stampeding our hospitals into mergers that really aren't creating the kind of efficiencies that were proposed. So here's another study. This is National Business Economic Research Working Paper. These people do all kinds of health and other economic research. For the business community. Can governments do it better? Merger mania and hospital outcomes in the English National Health Service. So I think what's interesting about this is that this was already happening in another country. It was happening in England with some of the reforms, neoliberal reforms that were going on in England with their National Health Service, where they were looking at merging hospitals and to gain greater efficiencies. So we examined the impact of mergers on a large set of outcomes, including financial performance, productivity, waiting times, clinical quality, and find little evidence that mergers achieve gains other than a reduction in activity. So, which meant they actually, people got fewer visits, fewer hospital days, those sort of things. In addition, mergers reduced the scope for competition between hospitals. So, kind of conclude here. If there's one thing that economists know, it's that market concentration drives prices up and quality innovation down. And I'm not so sure that this whole thing isn't anything other than a one more opportunity for transaction specialists who don't look a sick patient in the eyes to create large profits for themselves by stampeding our hospital systems into mergers. This guy, Martin Gaynor, recently became the head of the FTC Bureau of Economics. Oops, sorry. And these are a couple of quotes from him. And this is the guy who's going to be looking at these hospital system mergers and thinking about future antitrust cases against them. Accountable care organizations may prove anti-competitive. Merger activity has jumped in anticipation of the law fully coming into effect. Hospitals want to maintain their revenue streams and enhance their bargaining leverage. This is the way to do so. To bend the healthcare cost curve downward, their leverage must stop growing. So people are looking at this merger mania and wondering, you know, about its benefit, even federal bureaucrats wondering about it. So to summarize, managed care and the consolidation of insurance industry and the Affordable Care Act, and in my view, having read these articles, healthcare business consultants have stampeded health providers into these mergers. using a lot of fear sort of language. 22% of the hospitals that are for profit, but they were among the major drivers of these mergers. 67% of the mergers were from 22% of the hospitals. And due to mergers, 77% of our hospital markets are now considered highly concentrated, where competition is unlikely to be useful between them in terms of controlling costs or improving quality. And the transaction of these costs of these hospital mergers has spun about $10 billion a year off into individuals' hands that never look a sick patient in the eyes. Hospital consolidation does not improve quality unless they're administered prices. And within our current system, that's the only in Medicare, Medicaid, would you find administered prices. And it's increasing prices in areas where these markets are concentrated and there's market pricing. And consumers lose about as much as $4 billion yearly due to these higher prices. And then the mergers have actually increased the number of underinsured by maybe 500,000, and who knows how many more, because that's basically old data looking at what the effect of the mergers has done. So I suspect that even a larger number of people have ended up uninsured, and most of those lost private insurance. So who? I mean, who's going to stop this whole idea of merger mania and ever greater corporate power within the healthcare field? Well, my personal view is it's kind of up to us. We're the ones who have to speak out about it, both as clinicians and as experts in public health. And certainly my personal opinion that a single payer like an improved Medicare for All, as represented by HR 676, would be a good answer to this. A single payer would have what's called monopsony power, a single purchaser. And on that side, it would represent us as the public, not the corporate interests. So the move toward an improved, expanded Medicare for All Americans with monopsony purchasing power, we're heading toward monopoly or oligopoly. I think we better have monopsony on the other side to control these large corporate entities whose principal interest it looks like, especially with the merger being driven by for-profit hospitals, would be profit and not patients. It would be publicly accountable if we went that way and transparent instead of profit-oriented and collusive, which is what's happening behind the scenes now. And we'd cover everyone, save money, we'd save lives. And it's the right thing to do. But how do we get there? That's the question. Well, I know we won't get there without a fight. You know, I was told not too long ago by somebody who's kind of shady in my practice, I take care of we were talking about the prison system. We're not talking about people who know about these things more than I certainly do. That it's somewhere maybe $10,000 to $15,000 to get somebody professionally killed in the Detroit area, and these guys are taking down billions. And if you think they won't do what they can to keep taking down those billions, you better be ready for the fight, because it will be a fight, and we've got to be part of that fight. And we won't have the strength to fight without organizing, and that includes here in the APHA, which means that we need to continue to stand for systems that are publicly controlled, transparent, focused on patient care, focused on quality, and not focused on corporate ideals of profit and power. And this is a permanent struggle. We know, some of my Canadian colleagues are here in the audience, we can see what the same people who would like to create these strategies for merger and transaction and corporate power are beginning to invade our Canadian friends. And so this is a permanent struggle. We're talking $3 trillion we spend every year on healthcare. They will continue to want to have their piece of that $3 trillion. And so that means that whatever we create, it has to be durable. And we have to educate other young professionals, partly why I'm here talking today, to sustain organizations that maintain the struggle. And here in the U.S., that's organizations like Physicians for National Health Program, which I, you know, this is a conflict of interest, but I'm past president of that organization, and the American Public Health Association, if we organize it to stand up strong, and organizations like Healthcare Now, which carry on the lay side this struggle to get healthcare for all that's publicly open and transparent and serves patients, not profits. But power concedes nothing without a demand, and we need to make that demand. So thanks. So I think we have a few minutes for questions. I don't know if maybe the panelists can come up, Dr. Cha, Jennifer. If there's questions about any of our three presentations, I don't really consider myself personally an expert on this issue, but I probably know more than most people in my profession now, having studied it a bit. But so, yes. Yeah. I think that the telling thing on the frequency of mergers is the fact that most of them are being driven by for-profits. That's the thing that disturbs me the most when I saw that they make up 22% of the hospitals and yet are involved in over two-thirds of the mergers now. So the concern that I saw there, it isn't that most of these mergers are happening from, and I'm absolutely sure that it's true, there probably are some thoughtful things going on. I can tell you that, you know, here we are. I work in a Catholic healthcare system, 501c3, nuns on the board, mission driven. The mission's everywhere in every hallway, right? I walk by St. Marguerite Duville every day in my in the front end of our lobby as I walk to my office. So you know, it's very mission oriented, very thoughtful that way. And yet, at the highest levels, the conversations that I've been involved in as a leader in that organization, some of the decisions I find are relatively shameful. I'll give an example. And then I'll flip to our competitor side and their behavior. But and both these are not-for-profit systems, theoretically with a mission to serve our community. In our system, we had two hospitals that were downtown that were owned by our system. One was an osteopathic hospital. Another was a small Catholic hospital. Both of those were closed. A brand new hospital was built. They are both downtown center city, low income area services. There's a third hospital that was struggling and was not going to be able to successfully, you know, continue to be open. They're probably going to bankrupt if nothing else happened. That was in the near north end of town, which is among the poorest parts of our town. So there are three additional downtown hospitals besides the main teaching hospital I work at. All of them small, all of them weak. We closed those three hospitals. Reduced hospital beds. In that sense, good planning. Where do you think we built our new hospital after we closed those three? Where the money was. And again, when I talk with leadership, they, you know, the need was in our area. Our emergency room was not designed to take on the uninsured and underserved population of those other three hospitals. Our emergency room was flooded. Now, eventually, on the back side of that, they, you know, did some remodeling and eventually grew the emergency room to a size that could handle these populations. But it was a tremendous stress on the system for a while as more of these uninsured and underserved patients showed up in our hospital emergency room. And they built a new hospital, beautiful new hospital, in a suburban area of town where there was money and insurance. And this is 501c3. Now, they're still serving the mission. I mean, the mission was still there in our big teaching hospital. You know, there were still services that were there for them. But many of the doctors that were affiliated with these hospitals who had offices on campus at these other, gone off to be close to that new suburban hospital with its well-paid patients. So that's what I saw in my own community. In the 501c charitable Catholic walk by St. Marguerite every day institution that attracted me originally as a healthcare provider to stay and actually want to work and teach in that environment. So even what I would call the best of intended circumstances, you know, the money is driving this. And their decisions about money were driving it. Now, I don't know about other places. In Ohio, the Republican legislature and governors that we've had these last few years eliminated certificate of need. So none of these transactions or other things were scrutinized by the public in any official way where community testimony could be taken. So there's no public oversight for these transactions in Ohio. I know there are other states that still have certificate of need, so if you want to build a new hospital, you've got to do something about it. But and actually another kind of instigator, I should mention, at least in Toledo, Ohio, of our doing our kind of merge and put a new hospital in the rich area, the opposite system, we had a hospital on the east side of Toledo, well supported by the east side of Toledo's community. People don't like to cross the river in Toledo for anything, you know, for shopping, anything. They like to stay on their side of town for whatever reason. It's just a tradition. And we had a Catholic hospital over there that was did very well. And our competitors, the other large system, put a 120-bed kind of low-techie hospital within 3 miles, not even that, probably within a mile and a half of that hospital, built a new one on the east side. Both those hospitals, from what I can see, consistently have low utilization because what's happened is there's more beds there than we need now. So the other system expanded beds, you know. Functionally, one could argue, just, you know, took the beds that we closed and rebuilt them right, you know, to poke us in the eye on the east side. Again, a not-for-profit system.
So part of this is a discussion about what is thoughtfully.
Yeah, thank you, yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry. For our others here? Yeah, thank you.
Jennifer.
Jen, why don't you come up?
What's the evidence that formerly incarcerated people are bad employees or not?
There really isn't any evidence either way. Again, based on some interviews that have mainly come out of L.A., primarily UCLA, but some other agencies in Southern California, who interviewed employers from different industries, not necessarily healthcare or hospitals, but like they did hospitality and retail. The qualitative feedback they got was basically like they're afraid of liability, they're afraid of being sued, how misconduct based on the employee's part. But there's no like real evidence that shows that any of that is true. That's just based on an opinion. And so yeah, there's no evidence to. But again, I think it's just like the stigma that we still attach to incarceration and conviction. It doesn't allow people to get over it. And we talked a little bit earlier too, like especially in New York State, like it's only like 13% where it's actually violent criminals. Like most of, you know, in the U.S., it's generally drug related charges, and so these are not violent job applicants. Yeah, but yeah, there's no evidence.
Have you created any kind of support group for the people that you're working with?
We haven't. That's actually my next step. So at Montefiore and Bronx Transitions Clinic, we partner with a CBO, a community-based organization called the Osborne Association, that offers. So we do the medical component, and then they do a lot of the other reentry components for our patients and for their clients. We haven't, but that's a great idea, and something like that they've kind of tossed around it too as well. It's like, what more can we do for like job enhancement within with our patient or in that population as well? Yeah.
Maybe I'll ask another question to Dr. Chuck. Have you expanded your thinking at all? I mean, you witnessed this issue that political capital actually becomes healthcare capital, so mm-hmm. to speak, in these disturbed environments. But have you actually thought about looking at more well-to-do societies in terms of this issue of a person's political capital and what that means to their health? Has anyone else in your research explored these things in wealthier countries to look and see mm-hmm. whether your quote-unquote political capital, mm-hmm. or people try to define mm-hmm. what that political capital is from a sociologic perspective, mm-hmm. to look at what matters, what kind of political capital do you have? For example, if you have a doctor in your family, might be a component of political capital, both in Korea, but also in the U.S., in terms of the attention you might get or the quality of care you might get. Or, how wealthy are you, it certainly play a role in either place, mm-hmm. rather than a lot to some extent. I just don't know if you look
Actually, some research was done, as far as I know, though, in the Welfare Society regarding political capital is the their kind of the negotiation power, the not the individual, the for the a certain group of the individual have a more influence to the certain health policy and it make a better access and a better system for the that group. And so in the well stabilized democracy, it is related to the vote rate of the certain marginalized group and to change their political capital to the better healthcare capital. So just the reason why I'm focusing on the rapidly changing society, those kind of society have a certain kind of the chance to change the dynamic of the each capital. Example, political and economic and social capital was mixed and there is a lot of changes over there. And in certain society, capital, the economic capital, have a more strong sustainability to keep their the healthcare access and those kind of things, because normally those kind of society have the poor governance of the government. But on the other hand, the country like North Korea, who have a very strong governance, political power of the government, have sometimes previous existing political capital can be easily changed to the economic capital. It was what I found. So we need to, it is very context specific issue, but rapidly changing society, we need to have a more focus on the political capital. I think.
Oh, for the 7 million New Yorkers? Yeah, well, I mean, I can't speak for all the health systems in New York State, but I know for Ed Montefiore specifically, they do, in addition to that question, they do a formal background check as well. So it takes your whole life history, so someone who did, a drug-related charge in their 20s and their 40s is still, being affected by it. And again, as we talked about a little earlier, the community health worker program that we have is specifically for people who are formerly incarcerated. So that requirement is something that's brand new, but something that's really burgeoning in the healthcare system to have community health workers who are formerly incarcerated dealing with these populations. Yeah.
A lot of people,